Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is April 23rd. We have returning guest Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including most recently, The Mythology of Progress and Self-Reliance in the 21st Century. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. And recently, he started up a great Substack at charleshughsmith.substack.com. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's my pleasure to be on your program, always.
Great. Yeah, and I thought today we'd do a discussion, a focus on the trade issues, the tariff issues that are big on everybody's mind and what's happening in the global economy. It also touches upon mercantilism and versus comparative advantage, right? Those two, and how the countries are relating, especially with the U.S. tariff plan. So maybe we begin with that. Your initial thoughts on that, and then I can go into what I see as relating happening to the capital flows.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Richard. Yeah. I do want you to speak to your recent piece on Cedar Owl on Substack, which was a great informative piece with lots of charts about capital flows. And I think what you were describing was that capital is being repatriated out of the U.S. to the home countries. And I think my context for that is too much of the global capital had been concentrated in the U.S. And that was not healthy for the global economy or for the U.S. because capital needs to go to work, so to speak, around the globe. And so if one country has too much capital, then it just creates asset bubbles, which is what we've seen in the U.S. in terms of stocks and real estate. So within that idea of rebalancing being a positive force, then that's kind of my theme of the context of looking at trade, tariffs, currencies, and capital flows, because I think that the rebalancing is necessary and a positive, although it will deflate, you know, the overvalued markets in the U.S., because as capital leaves, there's no replacement source of buying. And so I think that you've run the statistics on how much of the global capital, kind of the free floating capital in the world, was allocated to the Mag 7 stocks, you know, an intense concentration there. And that created a bubble, you know, in those stocks, and then that bubble's deflating, and so people look at that in the U.S. and go, oh, that's terrible, right? But actually, it's a positive thing to spread the capital around, and it's in a similar sense. I think we can look at trade as being also in need of rebalancing, and maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you mentioned, things got very extreme and out of balance in many respects. So we can look at both the equities market in the U.S. and the bond market in the U.S. First, on the equities, with regards to Mag 7, right, the technology, the seven top technology U.S. listed equities, NVIDIA, Tesla, these ones are... They have been very with concentration risk in the U.S. equities market. So the numbers are, in terms of to show the extremity, U.S. is only 4% of the world's population, has only about 20% of the world's GDP, but we basically got to the point where 60, 65, 70% of all the investable capital in the world has been in the U.S. equities market. And then if you take a subset of that, it basically comes down to a 30% in the Mag 7. And then as you can see here, nearly one-fifth of U.S. equities is owned by foreign investors, 18%. So, you know, there's lots of extremes that happened in the equities market. And so what we've been seeing now in the last 2 weeks is a lot of selling in those particular Mag 7 equities. You know, you see it down 4%, down 5%, down 7%. And one thing to notice is the three indicators, or when you have stocks going down, bonds going down, and the dollar going down, that's not good. And so what it indicates is a very high probability that you've got foreign investors, or even at the entity level, government level, whoever, they're going in selling, you know, these Mag 7 equities or other types of U.S. equities, but in particular the Mag 7 because of the large concentration, as indicated, a large amount held by foreign citizens and entities, and repatriating the money back home, right? Dollars going down. And this was not only in the equities market, but also in the bond market, right? Because you've got massive, huge bond market in the U.S., given the excessive amount of U.S. government debt. So, you know, some of the data is not out in particular for April, not yet, but there's indications you've got Japan either in the form of the government or more likely and more as a higher percentage from companies, Japanese companies selling U.S. Treasury bonds, repatriating the money back home to help on their industrial development. You've got Canada that was also a net seller in January. China has been selling as well. They've been selling not only just recently, but over a multi-year period. As shown here, this is a five-year view and also a little bit longer view here. So China holdings of U.S. Treasuries going down. Again, that would have the tendency to push yields higher as well, meaning bond prices go lower. So all of this is happening in terms of international capital flows. So we have in the posting here lots of interesting charts, including this one from Armstrong Economics, which is a monthly indicator looking out on a monthly basis. As you can see here, projected capital flow trends internationally on a monthly basis. Green meaning capital going in, net capital going in. Red means going out, and the sort of yellow orange is projecting a higher low. So if you see the U.S., it's projecting a higher or low, which makes sense. It's just this is from a couple of weeks back, just before the beginning of the selling. So yeah, this is a lot of charts that indicate how you know what's happening in terms of capital flight, selling of U.S. assets, again, to your point, Charles, based on a very imbalanced world and, you know, a trend towards a more balanced world is a good thing. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, absolutely. And this, of course, includes currency, like as you said, the dollar's gone down as there's been mass selling. But and then a lot of people take the idea that you can draw like a straight line. Okay, the dollar's going to zero because it's being sold. I don't know that it's going to zero. I think it just means it's part of this rebalancing. That I think that the dollar, in terms of like the percentage of one currency that was used in global trade, and it was considered a reserve currency. The U.S. dollar was up there around 60%. And so if it declines to, say, 50% or 40%, that would actually be a positive element as far as I'm concerned, because what we all want is a competitive, transparent market in everything, including currencies, including trade, including capital, right? So all that seems to me to be good. It doesn't mean that there's some kind of thrash in U.S. The U.S. economy or but I think the rebalancing is a way of de-risking the world, because if you have too much wealth or power in one location or asset class, then you're created a great risk, right? And because all bubbles pop. And so this is part of the de-risking of the whole global economy. And of course, it's showing up in the U.S. because this was where the wealth was concentrated, right? Over-concentrated. So I also want to speak real quickly to this idea that, you know, what is the core idea of trade? And the core idea of trade in classical capitalism was comparative advantage. And so the idea being that one country, like say Portugal, makes good quality, low-cost wine, and then they would buy, say, cotton cloth from England, and then England would buy the wine. And so it was like a fair trade that benefited both sides. And then the idea of a mercantilist trade is one side has an advantage. And one example is, of course, a colonial power, right? That the colonial powers were a form of mercantilism, because they would impose restrictions on the colony, that they would have to buy the products, the finished goods from the colonial power. And then they would have to sell their resources at low prices to the, so, and that's the kind of the heart of the difference between a fair trade and then a mercantilist trade. And so I think what President Trump is responding to, and a lot of people are feeling the same thing, is that the U.S. was had a more open market than many of its competing developed nations, and that therefore our market was open, but the our competitors' markets were more restricted. And so because they were kind of using a mercantilist model of creating, you know, benefiting exports and then generating trade surpluses that would then increase the wealth in the home country. So my context is the U.S. enabled this or even encouraged this as part of the Cold War, that back in the late 40s and 50s, the allied countries of Europe and Japan and Asia had been devastated in the war, and therefore the U.S. had to do something to help them. And of course, in terms of cash and loans, it was the Marshall Plan. But perhaps more important than the Marshall Plan, it was like opening the U.S. economy to our allies' exports. And so that generated eventually by the 60s and 70s, that generated a huge trade surplus for our allies and a trade deficit for the U.S. And that was the core driver of the Bretton Woods agreement that we all refer to now, right? To try to rebalance that trade and the currencies. And so I think kind of in a larger context, the post-war era, you know, lasted for like 50, 60 years until the Soviet Union fell. And then there was this period of adjustment and the rise of China. And so now we're in the same kind of era where we need to rebalance again. You know, there was a rebalancing in the Bretton Woods era, and then now we need another rebalancing. And so everybody's kind of fighting for an advantage, which is, of course, reasonable, right? Everybody wants an advantage if they can get it. But it's not actually good for the world economy if somebody has an advantage, right? It's better to have an open market where people have to kind of jockey for position and competition and in everything, trade, currencies, tariffs. And so that's going to be painful, right? Because the status quo has been disrupted. But I think it's all to the good, you know, that the rebalancing of across all these markets was necessary.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to review also on that history and to emphasize what you just mentioned, Charles, we have a Substack posting going out tomorrow, and here's a section of it. We make reference to the former Greek finance minister, Vanis Varoufakis. He gave a really good presentation. We post the whole presentation. It's only 32 minutes, a must watch. And in it, he goes through the time frame from 1968 when the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger knew historically that every empire that went from being a surplus country to a deficit country faded its hegemony. So he asked his advisors, what should we do about it? And the strategy at the time suggested to actually increase the deficits and thereby create a net aggregate demand, as you mentioned, for the net exports for Germany, Japan, and later for China. And so this enabled the U.S. dollar to be the world's reserve currency and the whole monopolistic global U.S. dollar payment system. So that's been working for several decades, causing this great imbalance, as you mentioned. Your thoughts on that, Charles?
Yeah, that absolutely brilliant. And Varoufakis is also excellent at discussing what I would call neocolonialism. And in a way, what he's describing, I would call neocolonialism, which is one nation is attempting to erect a structure that benefits them more than everyone that they're trading with. And so that's where a lot of people have referred to the U.S. dollar hegemony as an unfair advantage. So the fact that global capital is leaving the U.S. and alternatives to the dollar are arising, I don't see it as something to panic over. I actually think it's a positive, even for the U.S., because as I said, if you try to concentrate too much wealth and control in one place, then you end up creating risks compared to, like, say, a more decentralized competitive system. And so I'm looking forward to reading the Cedar Owl piece on this this topic. And so if we're going to try to contextualize what's happening, I think I would say that the overvalued U.S. Markets will decline because capital's leaving, but it's leaving for a good purpose. It's not trying to, quote, damage the U.S. It's simply trying to find a lower risk, more productive home. And the world is often starved for capital. And we've often discussed this about where the global South has been starved of capital and innovation and intellectual capital. And so it's a benefit for the global economy and eventually for the U.S. to strengthen the global South as to let capital go back there and be invested productively instead of sitting in Mag 7 stocks, which are kind of dead money, frankly.
Yeah. And even as China recently came out with more of a software-based version on AI to promote AI development versus a very costly hardware-based approach that the U.S. was initially taking. That's another example of that. And, overall, the vision that we see together is a rebalancing, internationally of capital flows, of investment, and in different payment systems in a multipolar world, right? All making it a better and more stable, diversified global economy. And at the same time, in this vision of the rebalancing, still with a vision and a place for free trade, promoting as much free trade as possible, because you want to have the idea of globally competitive industries, right? Not protected and sheltered by tariffs, right? Which would protect, you know, very low quality businesses, not non-globally competitive, and higher cost, right? So that's not good for the consumer anywhere. So, you know, it's best to have higher quality products, lower priced, innovation based, as much as possible towards that comparative advantage vision, but in a more balanced setting, right, around the world.
Right. And I think absolutely. And I think we can also kind of add like dependencies, you know, in other words, part of what's a risk in any kind of market is if someone becomes overly dependent on one source of either, you know, resources or capital. And so the U.S. has become dependent on China for many, you know, resources and products. And of course, that does create a national security risk, just like it would if China were dependent on the U.S. for particular resources, right? I mean, nobody wants to be dependent on some other country. And I think so that's part of what we're talking about when we rebalance. We're rebalancing risk and also dependencies. Like, it's actually better if there's a more decentralized world where nobody is like totally dependent on one source for an essential part of their national economy. So I think that's a positive development as well, too, kind of a rebalancing. And because every country has to protect its borders and its national security, right? I mean, you don't want to be dependent on another country for your food or your fresh water or all of your energy. I mean, that's like, that leaves you vulnerable, and then that creates risks of conflict and suffering, right? So I think that's kind of like what we're looking at as a positive is as capital is goes back home, so to speak, then maybe it'll be put to good use, right? Developing more resources, more healthier food, a more diverse economy, because obviously it's not good for any nation, I don't think, to be too dependent on exports, right? I mean, ideally, maybe 10 to 15% of your economy might be exports. And then beyond that, then you're creating a risk for your economy by becoming too dependent on exports. And so a little, as you and I were talking before we started recording, it's not so much that globalization is ending, which was your point, but again, it's being rebalanced and in a positive manner. And maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, a lot of people think globalization is fading away or dying. I see it more as now being actually going higher in the global South BRICS plus world, even intensifying, especially due to the tariffs from the U.S. Is accelerating that process. The de-globalization is more concentrated, I see, in the G7 world, where there's challenges in the tariffs and between different countries, all especially due to excessive government debt, you know, interest rates going higher, right, and the difficulty in servicing that excessive government debt that has been built up over the years, essentially since World War II. So yeah, it's a bit of a bifurcated world in that sense, but nonetheless, still continuing on, you know, for globalization. I was wondering also on one of your recent books, Self-Reliance in the 21st Century, seems like it would be a good book to look at in regards to what you just mentioned, you know, for self-reliance. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, thank you, Richard. Yeah, I think that it's like a matter of scale, and it just as you don't at the largest scale, you don't want a nation to become overly dependent on unique sources for essentials. You also don't want to, you don't want that for your household or your community, right? In other words, it's you're creating risk by being becoming dependent on, like, say, food and energy from thousands of miles away, if there's a potential for developing those resources locally, right? And so then that, it doesn't mean that you're going to eliminate trade or, but you're going to become less dependent on it. And then that increases your stability and your self-reliance. And so, in other words, it's sort of like we were discussing with competition. If there's only one provider, it's kind of like the company town, then they can, you know, they can force like low quality products at high prices. And that dependency on the company store is the source of the problem, right? And so if there's competition, then there's more self-reliance, especially if you have local sources. And so I see this whole idea of reshoring essential production as a positive for everyone in the world. In other words, every country should be looking at not at reducing their dependencies and in increasing their independence, right? And their local production of essentials. And so in that sense, I think the self-reliance concept plays well around the world. And that, you know, when we look at, I'll just give a quick example. Like, consider the price rise of rice in Japan, which is the staple, you know, grain in Japan. It's doubled in price. And you can say, well, this is for a lot of reasons behind it, right? But obviously, if you can, the one solution there would be to increase local production of rice, whatever that takes, right? So that's an example of self-reliance. You don't want to become dependent on some other source if you could develop that resource on your own. So I see it as a kind of tying into this whole idea we have of capital going home and being put to good use. And I think that's a really positive development, actually.
And in previous podcasts, we've had this vision series where we've done maybe 8 or 9 podcasts we've discussed, which actually could be used as a blueprint for how to reshore and do the manufacturing renaissance in the U.S. I've listed here in one of our postings the summary of some of those discussions that we've had. Many of these are not even being looked at yet, so that this is going to be the challenge. But I mean, one of them, we did a whole podcast on this one here, on the regulatory landscape. We talked about regulatory capture and how that's hindering innovation. And so, you know, what should we do about it? How do we minimize that, even relative to a democracy that is representative based? Yeah, how that factors in, maybe a move towards more direct based democracy. But yeah, so some of these we talked about, you know, promoting and fostering education, training, right, especially in engineering, AI, those areas, right, that will help foster new globally competitive industries, maybe initially setting up a visa program because of the lack of engineering talent in the U.S., right? It's been more focused in the finance sector and healthcare sector in recent decades. So this is some of the themes that we've come up with on these areas. Your thoughts on this, Charles, and relating it back to the podcast that we've done in the past?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the vision series, Richard, because we'd actually laid out this roadmap, which is basically a series of ideas all aimed at opening up the U.S. economy to more competition and breaking down like barriers around kind of protected elites, if you will, you know, that when an elite can build a regulatory, you know, barrier or a moat around itself, then it doesn't have to do good work anymore. And it can be sloppy and overcharge. And so, and I think there's a lot to be said about the kind of the regulatory structure that serves, you know, the largest corporations and the federal government. You know, it's kind of hand in glove to the detriment of the population and the nation as a whole. And so what our ideas are to try to break that down and allow sort of bottoms up innovation and allow, you know, the development of new companies, right? Make it easy to start a business, make it easy to innovate, and to provide, as you said, the training and workforce that has the skills to do the reshoring and innovate.
Yeah, that's a good summary of what we've been discussing, and it can serve as a blueprint. And hopefully it's looked at. We even actually came up with the similar DOGE idea to the Department of Government Efficiency. I remember we did one that sort of was aligned with that even before DOGE was created. So yeah, some really good podcasts that we had.
Yeah, we should be, of course, advisors to every government.
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But and the thing that I, just as a last point, I don't see that there's any benefit in trying to say that one idea is progressive and one is conservative or something. I don't think that ideology really plays into this. What we're really discussing is practicalities. Yes. Don't you think that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. What's practical? What works? Even a recommendation or suggestion towards a more limited and efficient government, right, to allow the private sector to be bigger and create jobs and promote innovation and, you know, that type of global competitiveness, right, overall, which if you, on the other hand, if you have a larger expanding government, it tends to try to justify its existence and it crowds out the work of the private sector. So it becomes increasingly difficult, right, for innovation and to change. So those are just right. Some thoughts.
Yeah. And it also, that big regulatory burden also crushes local business, which is what, you know, the whole idea of self-reliance is, that we want to encourage relocalization of the essentials, you know, like which includes industry and food production. And so that's where a lot of the U.S. has been hollowed out, not by foreign trade, but by corporations dominating the economy and government restrictions limiting the growth of small business, you know, relocalizing. So that's part of the picture here. And what we're suggesting is letting capital, or encouraging capital, to go back to smaller communities and develop industry and food production there. And then that boosts the economy locally, which helps for national self-reliance. So it all fits together.
Yeah. And maybe we can end on if you could relate your blog writings and your books, because all of that really expands and elaborates on these ideas. Just fantastic insight and even guidance that it can serve not only communities at the individual level, but also entity and government levels. Can you relate where our viewers and listeners can learn more about that?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Yeah, I have all of my books have sample chapters, and they're all on my website, oftwominds.com. And then my Substack, most of my articles are free. So if you go to Charles Hugh Smith, substack.com, then you can review the last year and a half or so of my essays. So thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate our wide-ranging discussion today.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, thank you so much, Charles. We'll do it again. Thank you. Take care.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.